Strategy and Insider, exploring future trends and their impacts.
Hello and welcome to the Strategy and Insider podcast, where we explore the future of health together with leading experts in the health domain. I'm Thomas, your host and a partner at Strategy and. Today's episode is particularly special for two reasons. First of all, I have the privilege of welcoming not one, but two distinguished guests, which always kind of adds an extra layer of excitement to our conversations. And secondly, we will delve into really a brand new topic that we have not yet explored so far. A subject I am personally very eager to discuss actually for some time by now, which is the role of behavioral science in impacting our health as well as the healthcare ecosystem as a whole. That said, I'm very honored to be joined by two renowned academics from this field. A very warm welcome to Professors Urte Scholz and Claudia Witt. Urte is the head of the Applied Social and Health Psychology Department at the University of Zurich and serves as a full professor there. She actually started her academic career at the Freie Universität Berlin, where she studied psychology and eventually also earned her doctorate back in 2005. Urte then moved to Switzerland for her first stints at the University of Zurich before becoming a professor at the University of Bern. After a short stint at the University of Konstanz, she actually returned to Switzerland to assume her current role back in 2013. And until recently, she served as the president of the Swiss Society of Health Psychology, while her research focuses on health behavior change and coping with stress and illness. My second guest is Claudia Witt, who is also a full professor of medicine at the University of Zurich. And like Urte, Claudia studied also in Berlin, where she earned her doctorate in medicine from the Humboldt University and also holds an MBA from the Berlin School of Economics. Back in 2006, she became a professor of social medicine and epidemiology at the Charité in Berlin, where she taught and researched in the fields of complementary medicine and social medicine. And actually, 2014 was a very decisive year for her, as this marks the start of her current, but also numerous other roles. Because since then, she is the director of the Institute for Complementary and Integrative Medicine at the University Hospital in Zurich, and does also have a full professorship at the University of Zurich that I was mentioning previously. So Claudia also holds various other roles, such as being the co-director of the Digital Society Initiative, which is the University of Zurich's competence center for digital transformation in society and science. Her research actually focuses on digital health, mind-body medicine, and integrative oncology that we're going to also delve into a bit more later today. So as you can tell from this rather long introduction, I'm really joined by two absolute experts for behavioral science and healthcare. And with that said, a very warm welcome to the professors Urte Scholz and Claudia Witt.
Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Hey, as mentioned earlier, I don't have the chance too often to have two guests on our podcast. But when I do, I'm all the more curious on how the two of you actually met. Could you probably share with us a bit how each other you got to know and describe how you actually work also together?
Yeah, that's a nice story. I had certainly heard of Urte and her work, but we truly got to know each other when we developed the postgraduate training. And perhaps Urte, you would like to tell the story.
Yeah, I agree. It is really a nice story because, you know, I think that's, that was already in 2016 or 17 or so. And apparently both Claudia and me, we were independent of each other thinking about creating a new postgraduate training program in health psychology and mind body medicine. And I was actually first contacting Claudia because I absolutely wanted to have her to be one of the teachers in my training program. And then actually it turned out that Claudia had the very same thought in inviting me back to her training program. And then we sit down together and discovered that we have so much in common with the two fields of health psychology and mind-body medicine that we just decided to create a joint postgraduate training program. And this is actually what happened in, I think, 2017. And we're now in the sixth year of running this program.
And you're still a good match.
Absolutely.
And the program is very successful.
That's what I can easily spot already now, I have to admit. But this was already then in Zurich, right? So you didn't get to know each other when both being in Berlin. Okay.
No.
As I was kind of alluding to, your career path do have some geographic similarities, as both of you studied in Berlin and eventually became professors here in Zurich. Who would you say is the more authentic Berliner? And who seems to a bit more blend naturally as a Zurich local? So who is the one, who is the other? Can you share a bit?
I'm not sure about this. So I'm a born Berliner, and also I got married in New York, so it was always the big cities. I feel very at home now in a small village at the Walensee. And thinking about Zurich, it's really nice to be so close to nature. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure if I'm any more an authentic Berliner. But I really appreciate the University of Zurich, which is very international, very innovative, and especially interdisciplinary. And I think that's something Otto also might enjoy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think for me, it's more sort of maybe a personal development than because I went to Berlin when I was studying psychology and also doing my PhD there. And, you know, being in my early 20s, this was the city to be.
Got it.
But, you know, then moving to Zurich, that was also a wonderful step. And I think by now, so I'm for almost 20 years now in Zurich. And mm-hmm. I think now I wouldn't qualify as a Berlin inhabitant anymore.
Okay.
So I absolutely enjoy
the new home
of life
is here.
That you have
Got
in
it.
Zurich. Yes, absolutely.
Got it. Cool. So while staying on you a bit, probably, in addition to your academic research and teaching, you also serve as the president of the Committee of Psychological Counseling Services for Students at the University of Zurich and the ETH Zurich. Can you probably share what are the most common psychological issues these days that students seek counseling for? And with that in connect, has there also been a change in acceptance of mental health conditions, let's say over the last 10 years when you have been seeing this?
Yes, you know, I think being a psychological counseling service for the students, we naturally, or the people who are offering the psychological counseling, they usually have topics that are related to studying, mm-hmm. like motivational issues or maybe test anxiety and mm-hmm. all that, you know. And of course, I mean, it's a very, you can come there. It's really, this service is offered to students from both University of Zurich and ETH Zurich, so that they come with any issues they have free of charge. So of course, there are also people who then are referred to seeing psychotherapy or the like. But I think many, many students show up because they do have study-related
topics. Issues. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And with regard to the development of acceptance, I mean, you know, it's always, there are changes in numbers of students who are seeking psychological counseling. There was an increase actually up to 2020, so up to the COVID-19 pandemic. And there are, of course, many reasons related to that. And we actually also don't know what the reasons are for mm-hmm. increasing numbers, for example. But our idea, at least for one explanation, among others, was that there is a greater awareness of mental health in students and that they can you know, take action and do something mm-hmm. to improve their mental health. And then, you know, there was like the COVID pandemic, there was a bit of a drop, probably also, you know, because of the adjustment and only online counseling was being offered and so on. And we now again see a little bit of a decrease in numbers.
Decrease
in numbers. But, you know, again, this might be due to many reasons. And one explanation we do have here is because there was a change in law in Switzerland with regard to the offering of psychotherapy. So they changed from the so-called delegation model to a referral or prescription model, which made it easier for people now to sort of go almost directly to see a psychotherapist. Mm. And this might be one reason why they do not need to go to the psychological counseling services.
From the university.
Can go to a psychotherapist right from the start.
So, but bottom line, what you're saying is both awareness, but also the availability of solutions kind of might have increased the acceptance, but also the occurrence of numbers, higher numbers. Okay.
And, you know, as I said, we don't know. This is our
Sure, but that's kind of the hypothesis behind, right?
Yeah. Yes. And, you know, of course, there are long waiting times in parts for the psychotherapy, but nonetheless, this is one, one of our explanations. Yes.
And Claudia, you are co-leading the University of Zurich's Digital Society Initiative and also have expressed your own passion for digital health, AI, and also the relationship between humans and technology. What aspects of digitization in healthcare do you find particularly fascinating? And are there any potential challenges that need to still be addressed in order to see it really flourish in healthcare?
Yeah, as many people at the moment, I find especially fascinating AI and how it might transform healthcare. And we have really to understand that AI can essentially take over any task of human thinking. So there are almost no boundaries. And this makes it also very difficult to oversee. And the pace is unprecedented in history of medicine. And this is exciting and unsettling at the same time. And if I can pick one of the challenges, I would say it's really we must prepare for this new form of collaboration to have human AI teams and how they work together. And when we think about interprofessional care in healthcare, we already know that it is not so easy always to get the nurses and the doctors work together. But now imagine an AI, which is not just a software code. It brings in more intelligence than the typical softwares we had before. It's joining the team. And we really have to prepare for this, and we have to prepare now for it, because it will be there much faster than we think.
And can I just ask on that, because you're coming from the clinic, you're there every day, right? What is kind of the sentiment of the doctors, the nurses, around their openness of actually teaming up with an AI in the background? Is there openness that changes over time, or is there anxiety, or what's, or is it all you like?
There's a whole spectrum. So, and not only from the clinical side, I also give a lot of talks about AI in medicine and clinicians' networks and as professional networks. And I think there are a lot of people have a openness that it can solve some of the problems we have, but there's also big worry about taking over, especially those tasks which we wouldn't like to let go as clinicians. So I always have the example, if the AI is doing my case taking with a patient, I would not agree that this is a good support for me, because this is my way to build a relationship with my patient. If the AI writes a doctor's report and is doing all the documentation, I'm happy to leave this task to the AI. And I think we have to really talk about user-centric approaches here. And what I still see a lot in the market is technology-centric approach. So this is there because AI is able to do it. Instead, we have to go more, or bring more the humans into the driver's seat and say, okay, that's a task I would like to hand over to AI. Please develop technology for this.
Let's dive into our main topic today, which is obviously behavioral science and healthcare. First of all, from your perspectives, both as a psychologist, but also from a physician's perspective, respectively, how would you define this term of behavioral science and healthcare? Probably starting with you.
I would say it's definitely a transdisciplinary approach. And, you know, then from a health psychology perspective, I would emphasize that it's really about health behavior change, so lifestyle changes, and also, you know, prevention and health promotion, of course, plus chronic disease management, which would rather focus then, for example, on quality of life of patients.
Okay, thank you. How about the clinical side of it? Would you agree with that? Would you add something to that explanation?
No, I agree with Otto. And I have to say, from the clinical perspective, I'm particularly interested in how we can translate these insights really into practical change for patients, into research in the field, into patient care, but that at the end, it really improves the symptoms of our patients. And in medical studies, you don't learn much about it.
Yeah.
You learn nearly nothing about it. And I have to say, in my daily clinic, it plays an important role, but it also plays only an important role because I have this collaboration with Orta and we have developed this course together.
And what when preparing for our conversation today, I also delved a bit into your research, which centers around behavior changes on health, especially within the context of close relationships, like those with a partner, with family, with friends. Could you provide some insights into how these relationships currently influence our health from a research perspective?
Yes, you know, there's still, for me, very impressive research, although I'm doing this for such a long time. And, you know, for example, there's a recent meta-analysis so on the impact social relationships have on our health, and they had decreased mortality as the outcome, and they could indeed show that social relationships have a comparable impact to established risk factors for mortality, such as smoking or physical inactivity and the like. It's really super impressive. And this relates to both like the structural aspects of social relationships. That is, for example, measured on the number of social network partners you have, but it also applies to the qualitative aspects of social relationships. And that would be, for example, social support. And, you know, the explanation for this is, on the one hand, that your social relationships and your social network might buffer stress. So it has this also, of course, then the physiological aspects of lower stress or maybe better coping with stress in the long run. For this, the social relationships might help, for example, for the, with the social support they provide. And the other path that I'm particularly interested in my research is the health behavior path. You know, so that your social network partners, and it can be your romantic partner, which is, you know, potentially very influential because you're living together and doing many things together and so on. But of course, also your friends, your colleagues and so on, that they impact or influence your health behaviors, and that this again, it's one path explaining why social relationships have such an impact on our health.
And can I just ask a bit more on that? Because we're seeing, on the one side, a tendency that relationships, social relationships, are more and more digitized into a digital world of relationships. But at the same time, we have been seeing kind of societal shocks like COVID-19 that had an immense impact on us as society, but also geopolitical tensions, wars that are ongoing, and the omnipresence of those topics. Can you probably also share a bit, does this and how does this impact our health, seeing those kind of social dynamics, let's put it that way?
Yeah, it absolutely, of course, has an impact on the social relationships. Maybe to the first part of your question, with regard to the digital social relationships that we might have. You know, there's also a meta-analysis on the research on, for example, Facebook friendships and how this impacts health. And they also see effects on mortality. However,
positive or negative?
Positive.
Okay.
Good question. No.
Okay. Glad.
In terms of decreased mortality, right? But when they dived a little bit deeper into the topic, what they also saw that this is mainly those friends that you also have in sort of real life, you know. So friends that you really know and that you also sometimes meet offline. So this was apparently driving the effect. But, you know, there's both, of course. Also, so it's not all bad about digital.
That's good to hear.
Relationships, yeah. And, you know, I mean, the other aspects of social relationships and health that we also see is that social isolation, as you know, the other end of the social integration dimension, and also loneliness, mm-hmm. which is different from social isolation, right? So loneliness would really be a subjective feeling of not having the relationships that you wish for. And social isolation might be objectively measured, that you just don't have any social network partners mm-hmm. in your network, right? So both of them, so the rather objective social isolation, but also the subjective feeling of loneliness, these two sort of have very detrimental effects on health, right? So they would rather add to increased mortality. And there are a couple of meta-analyses showing that the COVID-19 pandemic, when, you know, they compared feelings of loneliness, for example, before the pandemic and then during or after the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And quite consistently, these meta-analyses show that there was an increase in loneliness. Small to medium effect. So it was not a huge increase as mm-hmm. is sometimes maybe transported in the media or so, but there was an increase. And it also depends on what groups you look at. So for example, younger people had a higher increase in loneliness from before to during or after the mm-hmm. Pandemic than middle-aged people. And also people with lower socioeconomic status had a greater increase and so on. So it depends a little bit on the effect sizes.
Got it. Mm. And as a physician, Claudia, you are familiar with the medical effects of what Urte just shared, I assume, right? So the impact of human behavior on health, whether stemming from individual actions or societal habits by and large. What are the most common health issues that can be actually attributed to behavior? And what are potentially effective prevention methods to live a healthy and happier life?
Yeah, I have to say that many of our today's major health issues, just take the example of cardiovascular diseases, diabetes type 2, obesity, but even some cancers are directly linked with our behavior. Mm-hmm. And depending on the disease, it can be the poor diet, especially the lack of physical activity, but also smoking, but also chronic stress can be a contributor to this. And the good news is there's prevention, so we can do something. But thinking about it, it's not so difficult. It's a more balanced diet, mm-hmm. which is a little bit more plant-based also. It's regular physical activity, not smoking, and maintaining social connections, as we have heard before here from Urte. And these things can be incredibly effective. But that this can work more broadly or on a population level, we also need supportive environments. Mm-hmm. So we need urban planning which encourages walking. Mm-hmm. We need public policy that makes healthy food affordable. And I think we're in a really good situation here in Switzerland, but I've also worked for 20 years in the US. And so it's different when we talk about cities where you can walk and countrysides where you want to get some healthy food. If you don't have a car, you might not have access to it. And the other thing is also digital tools can really support a healthier behavior if they are used in a supportive way.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, we all have that kind of mantra, an apple a day keeps the doctor away, kind of in our heads, right? And still we're humans. Sometimes we are lazy humans as well, and count me in, right? On a population level, what can be actually done also from a psychological point of view that people not only know that more sport, better dieting, no smoking, less stress, better sleeping patterns, that they not only know it, but they actually do it. Is there anything that we can do?
Yes, there is.
And what is it? No.
You know, I just, before I answer this, I just want to second that, you know, as a psychologist, we always focus on the individual and sometimes on the individual's social relationships. But of course, I mean, there are also structural influences. And this is super important. Just as you said, Claudia, I'm so glad you mentioned this. And, you know, it's really not only, let's put it like that, but it's very little has to do with knowing what to do, because most people and most smokers, for example, to give you a very concrete example, yeah. Most smokers know that smoking is not good for health, but yeah. more in general, maybe. And this is where psychology kicks in. So maybe I know that smoking is bad for health in general, but maybe I don't feel that it's necessarily bad for my own health.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
there's all the others, but mm-hmm. me.
Yeah. Okay. So that's called the optimistic bias.
Mm-hmm.
That's one point. So informing people about healthy behavior is important. And we still know also from research that just telling them what to do and what not to do and raising their risk perception and so on is simply not enough. So what people need to at least think of changing their behavior is that they need to see more advantages than disadvantages. And, you know, sometimes smoking has many advantages for people because this is the way how they deal with their stress. Mm-hmm. And if you take this away, then they don't know how to cope with stressful situations mm-hmm. anymore. So, you know, I mean, this is one first step, that you really be aware of also the many advantages mm-hmm. that is related to the unhealthy behavior, right? And then, I mean, you can know many, many things about what the good thing would be if you would change your behavior, but you would still not think that you are able to change it. And this is self-efficacy.
So a disbelief.
Yeah, you know, that's a super important construct in the health behavior change literature and also like maybe in general, that you feel self-efficacious, mm-hmm. that you're convinced that you can do things even if they are difficult, mm-hmm. right? So, and this is really, I think that's so important to acknowledge that even if you see many advantages and many more than disadvantages of the behavior change, but still you're not confident enough that you can do it, then you wouldn't even try. And then there's the good intentions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have many of them. I don't know.
Plus one, I would say, at least.
Yeah. And, you know, there's in health psychology, there's a concept we call the intention behavior gap. Because, you know, you can have many, many good intentions and never act upon them.
Yeah.
So that's not so much about willpower that you would do this, but it's simply strategies. For example, planning. And, you know, that's also sort of a no-brainer that you need to plan when to do your physical activity and when to buy the healthy food and so on and prepare that. But still, this is super effective.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly if you also plan what to do when obstacles arise. So maybe you really like to go for a walk. That's your physical activity, but you really don't like to do this when it's raining
mm-hmm.
or when it's too hot outside as today, right? So maybe not a good idea.
Yeah.
So actually preparing in advance to this situation occurring with a plan B, what to do instead in terms of your physical activity is also super helpful. And this is also what we see in the data, that really people who plan when, where, and how to do things and also plan what to do when barriers arise. And these can be super personal barriers, right? Then this would help.
And this is basically also probably the lead over, Claudia, to you, right? Because digital health solutions can be a great tool solution to help people see it coming before it is actually coming. So not go out for a run because the shower will come, right? But also more other things like nutritionals after a sport, that you are nudged to rather eat protein-rich meals and not go for a pizza from around the corner, but kind of nudging people positively. I assume this is then also where digital health can have a major play.
Yeah, I would say especially if it comes to individualization.
Mm-hmm.
So because Ute was talking about motivation and these aspects, and what I really see in my patients and what we also see when we include digital solutions, it's important to find something you really like to do.
Mm-hmm.
And very often you have to put some effort into it. And I just had this example. I was talking with my sports coach and I have not much time, but I got a new dog and now I have to walk my dog, but I also want to strengthen my muscles.
Mm-hmm.
And now we are developing especially exercises which I can do while I'm with my dog.
Mm-hmm.
So I save time. I'm highly motivated to do this. And when I do these defining of Yeah, in a way, the tasks people can do to be physically active or the relaxation exercise, I put really time into finding something they agree that they really want to do it and that makes sense for them. And digital tools can help to support this.
Totally makes sense, from societal learnings and patterns, really translating this into the very individual and make it fit for purpose for him or her, really is then kind of the nudge that it really takes.
Yeah, you really know one size fits all.
It's over.
Helpful.
No, yeah, it's not helpful. Yeah, exactly. Can I just continue, Claudia, asking, because you're also an advocate for non-pharmacological therapies, including integrative oncology. Can you probably explain how these approaches work and how strategies like mind-body practices or also lifestyle modifications that we already had touched a bit upon, at least, can support patients with even serious illnesses like cancer?
Yeah, I'm very passionate about integrative oncology because it really puts the patient into the center. And in a way, it combines the conventional cancer therapies with evidence-informed integrative medicine methods. Very often from mind-body medicine, this can be relaxation techniques, mindfulness, yoga, qigong. And since all of those need a lifestyle change because you have to practice it regularly, this is also what we train our students in the postgraduate training in. Mm-hmm. But it can also be acupuncture, for example. The idea is here really to improve quality of life, to reduce symptoms, but also to strengthen self-efficacy and resilience. But what I really like is that it allows cancer patients to be an active part of the cancer journey. And they appreciate if they can do something on their own. And because it's non-pharmacological, I don't have to worry with interactions with cancer therapy. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it makes it safer if you use it alongside a cancer treatment.
So it's a kind of a supporting environment that supports
supportive
beyond.
Care.
Supportive care.
Yeah, you just Cancer Survivor Day, and usually I show it as one of the options in supportive cancer care.
Great. No, thanks for sharing this. We touched upon that before, that mental health is receiving an increase in global attention with more individuals acknowledging their vulnerabilities, but also prioritizing their mental health and well-being. Despite this, there seems to be also a rise in mental health challenges. And we touched upon some of them at least. But from your perspective, what are some of the key influences on mental health well-being today?
Well, I think, you know, in health psychology, we very strongly focus on resources and protective factors. So, of course, there are also risk factors that we briefly touched upon, like the pandemic, for example, that was going on, or maybe also reading the news these days.
Right? Yeah.
You know, impose stress. But I think focusing on what people can do to cope with these issues is a very good way to go. And but so it's more the idea of the not so much asking what makes you ill, but rather asking what makes you healthy, right? And so here again, you know, social connections would be one of these protective factors that is super important, that people can strengthen their social relationships and make it meaningful relationships and focus on that. And then I think also lifestyle behaviors like physical activity, we know that there are beneficial effects for mental health as well if you do these.
And another rising trend next to mental well-being is the terminology of longevity, which is having the aim to prolong your life with the help of a healthy lifestyle, a more rigorous prevention, but also monitoring, but also leveraging innovative medicines like GLP-1 therapeutics and others. We have actually discussed this also in one of our podcasts earlier with guests like the investor Christian Angermeyer, who predicts that people will be living healthier if not completely healthy, well into their 120s, which is obviously quite something as a bold vision. How do you see this trend from a psychological standpoint, but also how can behavioral science contribute to that longevity element?
Well, you know, I think that's a very, you know, the wish for longevity is based in human nature somehow.
Maybe. Of course.
So it's very natural to envision that this is possible at one point in time. As Claudia also mentioned, you know, health behaviors are really strongly related to living healthily very long, right? So this would be where the behavioral science is related to the healthy longevity issue. From a psychological point of view, I particularly like, you know, the WHO definition of healthy aging, which is that people can do what they have reason to value. And, you know, I particularly like this definition because this also applies for people who are chronically ill and maybe very limited in what they can do. But if they still can meet their grandchildren, for example, and have fulfilling and meaningful social connections, then this is, in this definition, it's covered, right? So it's not, I think, of course, it's, you know, there's this quote that on, you know, longevity is not only about adding years to life, but also life to years. So this, of course, we also want to be healthy when we get older. But I think even if you're not healthy from like physical, from the physical health standpoints, then there is the possibility for healthy aging. And I very much like this, you know.
And that means that also here, one size fits all is not doing the trick, right? Because you might be physically impaired, but still super active, brain working, super smart, reading, listening, conversation with others. And one would probably say in sum, this is not healthier, but it's longer. But the individual would say, well, it's my life and I enjoy it. I love it, right? So it's that individual value. I think that sharpening is greatly appreciated. So that said, achieving a long, healthy life, both physically and mentally, is obviously a goal for many, as we just alluded to. And therefore, also some are more and more relying on enhancements to their bodies, which is another trend that we're seeing. And also, we have been running a survey recently amongst the general society, and there is increasing openness to actually enhancing their bodies. And we went all the way into biohacking, and we were super surprised to see that people increasingly are open to exploring this and using this. But still, Claudia, while you promote healthy lifestyles, you have also concerns about interventions like self-DNA experiments or body implants and the alike, kind of the more radical side of biohacking. What risks do you see pose in your opinion, and what are other potentially more natural methods to enhancing without going that far?
So biohacking is a broad field. And you already mentioned some of the more extreme approaches like self-DNA experiments, body implants. And I view them with a critical eye. And because a lot of these interventions really lack sufficient scientific evaluation, and sometimes we also have ethical or physical risks in them. So they're not yet there that it is something which should be used broadly in our population. And what is often overlooked is really the psychological dimension here. This constant push for self-optimization, it can itself become a source of stress. And the pressure to enhance our bodies, to monitor our health metrics, to continuously upgrade ourselves, our bodies, our mental status, in a sense, biohacking is for me a paradox, because promoting health by simultaneously putting up a new mental strain here. And so if we look what we can do on a more softer side, it's a more healthier lifestyle. It's mindfulness or relaxation exercise for mental health. It's physical activity, whatever we like there to do, but also have the balanced nutrition, having enough sleep. Mm-hmm. So it's not super cool not to sleep and be the stress manager. It's something which needs a cultural change also in higher management levels. So doing really something for our body and our mind. Very often people do something for their body, but forget that we also have to take care for our mental health. And for me, at the end, it's really the balance between the two, body and mind. Mm-hmm.
Certainly, there is a big spectrum, as you rightly say, in biohacking, right? So I'm using, since a couple of months, also an Oura ring to keep track of, and you have it as well, Ota, right? To keep track of my sleep and get a bit of management there. And it's good to understand more of my body. Is this biohacking or not, right? It's a part into it. And I still enjoy it. Yeah? I use it until I know my body well enough to probably cope with it without it. But I get the point, there is ethical dilemmas as well along the way of biohacking.
Yeah, but I think this is a really good example because so having these recordings of your sleep is seen as objective data in a way. And I have now more and more patients who really show me their data about their sleep and other things and say, my sleep was really bad. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, how did you feel when you woke up this morning? My sleep was really bad. You see it in my app. So to understand that this is just a different source of data, and it's a good source of data, but that our own subjective feeling in the morning, if we feel rested or not, is a different source of data, and both sources should be valued. It's again using all the data to make a decision at the end. So we have to be very careful with these digital tools that this is not the only data which counts, because it's also not the full truth we get in this data.
I totally agree, and I absolutely love the idea that you just mentioned, that it's just two different sources of data and that we should definitely also trust our subjective perceptions on sleep or whatever. And then again, you know, I probably wouldn't call this ring or having your phone with you all the time or the smartwatches biohacking. I would rather really call this, it's a source of
objective data collection.
Objective data collection that you can use or not. But if you use it, I think, you know, for example, before we had the smartwatches, the rings, the smartphones, you name it, we would never know how many steps we would go for a day, right? Yeah. You wouldn't count your steps. And, you know, I know there's a debate on whether or not this criterion of 10,000 steps is really a good criterion.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I mean, it's an indicator that might also help you if you have the goal to be more active in your life. Then this is what we call self-monitoring. And this is a tool that helps you with doing this, that you know what you're actually doing. You know, and you wouldn't know, as I said, with the step count, for example, you simply wouldn't know. So using, and I think that's part of the solution, maybe, using this data as a source of information for helping you changing your behavior and maintaining this change. I think that's super helpful, really. So I think there's both to it.
Got it.
Yeah.
So probably looking ahead while I have you around, getting your kind of expectations and goals or even wishes for the field of behavioral science, meaning what breakthroughs are you hoping for and what will we have seen in behavioral science and the healthcare system improvements around that in, let's say, 5 to 7 years from now, starting Claudia, with you first, probably.
So the first thing I personally hope is that we can integrate behavioral science more into the education of medical students, but also into patient care. We are not there yet. And I believe that digital tools will especially allow patients to get empowered, or also the healthy population. So we might play a lesser role, the health professionals, within this interaction. It might be directly between the app with AI and the person. But therefore, I really want to foster that we have to develop them user-centric, and that we have to keep in mind if they communicate the whole time risks the apps, that we might get other psychological problems or more psychological problems. So we really have to plan here for the future scenarios that it comes good for our population and also for ourselves.
Got it. And probably, Ute, over to you. Will we have made big strides around an apple a day, keeps the doctor away? Will we actually see that societal health, well-being will shift gears in 5 to 7 years? What's your hope? Give us some hope. Not to bias you. No, what's your perspective?
I think my hope or my wish would be that the healthcare system would acknowledge more the evidence of behavioral science. You know, because, I mean, you can, of course, pay for a gym membership from the health insurance side, right? Or you can also promote that people should use apps for their health. But I mean, you know, if they are not, for example, these apps, if the content of the app is not evidence-based, and we do have the evidence from behavioral science, but for a good app that would really help you efficiently to change your health behavior should do, if we don't distinguish the non-evidence-based and the evidence-based tools that we have, then I think that's not the way to go. So I would really wish for taking more really the science and the evidence into account and using this in the healthcare system.
So really a big thank you to both of you for making this episode so insightful and for sharing your expertise on this truly important topic. And what I'm taking away is that prevention and longevity, and I'm a true believer in this, by the way, has to bank on behavioral science. Without behavioral science, all the solutions that we're building digitally or in analog are not going to be helpful if we're not reaching the people's change in behavior. So thanks again for making time today.
Thank you very much.
So to our listeners, thank you very much for tuning in to today's episode. Please do let me know what you think of this and feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn or through our website. Also, please don't forget to subscribe to the Strategy and Insider podcast for more engaging discussions on the future of health. That's it. Until next time, stay safe and goodbye.
Strategy and strategy made real.